Hey y'all, how's it going? Well, I'm all read up, but I don't have the TV news on yet. I better turn it on just in case something blows up big. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Hey, it works again. After 2 weeks of being as broken can be. The goddamn thing works again. ScottHorton.org. 3,700 something interviews going back to 2003. Plus, you know, the whole show archives aren't updated for the past 2 weeks yet. Sorry about that. And you know what? I checked iTunes last night and it looks like they're not pushing iTunes. Man, I better write Dave and Matt on my hand here and remember to call these guys right after the show today. See if we can get the shows pushing iTunes and Stitcher and what have you, man. That's all important. But the website is there. The archives are there. The interviews that you may have missed are all there. And so, yeah, that's pretty good, right? Well, let's see. So there's Al Jazeera. I didn't even know I had Al Jazeera. I wonder how long I've had Al Jazeera. And then there's Fox News and CNN. You know, today I think we'll go with Andrea Mitchell. Alan Greenspan's wife. Top story. Huge story. 3,800 dead so far in this earthquake in Nepal. Can you imagine that? 4,000 people killed pretty much in a weekend. Mostly all at once. Did you see the footage of the giant avalanche that hit the base camp at Mount Everest? Anyway. Man, oh man, what a horrible thing. And I hate to wax all, you know, Jane Fonda and Utopian and a bunch of crap, but it was Gene Kirkpatrick, the neocon. Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations, former commie, turned right-winger, like, you know, all of Crystal's men. One of the group. Who said, oh good, now that the Cold War is over, we can go back to being a normal country in a normal time. Imagine that. It seems inconceivable now that a responsible, serious person in Washington, D.C. would recommend that America be a normal country in a normal time. Appeasement. Isolationism. Anyway. But... yeah, never mind libertarian paradise and all of that kind of thing. What if America was just a normal country in a normal time? Never mind our government, but our society would certainly, yeah, even through the government, for that matter, could certainly do a lot to try to help in situations like this where nature wars against humanity. Even the biggest and strongest of us are pretty frail when it comes to going to battle with tectonic plates and that kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's not really a fair fight. Tornadoes. I don't really think we need a state. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying. You know, I was in a debate one time with a neocon, and he liked to pretend that the purpose of the Navy is going to save Pakistanis from floodwaters. When the purpose of the Navy is to guarantee permanent global hegemony. And, oh look, a PR stunt. But what if we did just have a minimal Navy, and its actual job was limited to things like chinooking in a bunch of bottled water to Pakistanis and, you know, during flood times or whatever it is. Be a hell of a lot better way to win over the world to what does make America exceptional, and that is the degree to which our society believes in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That's about it. Skateboarding. Anyway, 3,862 people confirmed dead now, so it'll be over 4,000. Man, think about that. Almost as many Americans as died in the Iraq War in a weekend. Anyway, it's not really anti-war news, but kinda is. Patrick Coburn's coming up on the show. He's going to talk about an American-made disaster as opposed to a natural one in Yemen and just what to expect from that. So stay tuned for that. And then I got a ton of news today, of course, Israel, Palestine, Iran, as I mentioned, Yemen, the Islamic State. There's a gigantic war going on with the Islamic State right now. Ukraine and Russia. And I guess I'm going to spend a few minutes on the police state news here. First of all, go to FFF.org, and they have now published all the videos. Stop the wars on drugs and terrorism. Videos of the three great speakers, Radley Balco, Glenn Greenwald, and Ron Paul, from the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism conference that took place Saturday before last here in Austin, Texas, at the LBJ Library Auditorium there. And, yeah, man, it's really good. There's all the videos. Jacob Hornberger was the MC, and the Young Americans for Liberty were the co-sponsors of it. And Balco and Greenwald and Paul all gave great talks. And, yeah, check that out. Okay, the only regret I have is that I did not somehow coerce Hornberger into letting me do the introductions. So I had a great introduction to give to all three of those speakers. Right off the top of my head, no problem. Not that the Young Americans for Liberty didn't do a great job. They did a great job. But I'm just saying, I got pages worth of hyperbole about Ron Paul. You know what I mean? And I could speak the same way about Greenwald and Radley Balco, too. A lot of respect for the work that those guys do. And the Young Americans for Liberty, they were just unfamiliar. They were just reading from the script, which is cool, but anyway. That's the only thing wrong with the whole thing, is that I wasn't part of it. Yeah. More police state news here. In the couple of minutes before we go to break. Oh, I forgot to hit record on the backup recorder. Better get that going. White House pushes to keep power to shut down cell phone networks. Desperate to avoid oversight on secret self-granted power. Writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. In 2005, amid reports that the London subway bombers had used cell phones as detonators, the White House secretly established the Standard Operating Procedure 303, which granted the government the ability to unilaterally shut down all cell phone service in an area of its choosing when it feels it needs to. I love the way Jason writes. The details of the procedure are still not public, and a series of lawsuits aiming to, at the very least, get the basics of how the law even theoretically works have faced massive official opposition, with the White House and DHS desperate to avoid any oversight. We've seen this, right? Weren't there some protests in New York or something where all of a sudden they shut down all the cell phone service? If I had a bunch of lackeys, I'd have somebody Google it for me. I guess I could Google it. The power has become increasingly... Oh, here, of course, Jason's ahead of me. The power has become increasingly controversial in recent years as cell phone communication has increasingly replaced landline phones and would be more essential than ever during, quote, emergencies, the very time the administration wants to be able to silence them. An even bigger concern is that, with the details of the law secret, officials can just flat out abuse it to silence dissent. In 2011, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System used the kill switch to shut off all cell phone services in several stations, specifically to try to prevent organization of a public protest there. Yeah, you're not free. You live in a totalitarian police state. You knew that, though. Right? Yeah. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. wallstreetwindow.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all, welcome back. Here in a few minutes, we'll have Patrick Coburn back on about the war in Yemen. All right. So, Baltimore over the weekend, police arrest 35. Beat the crap out of a lot more than that. They claim 6 cops were injured, but I don't believe them. They're presumed liars until they prove beyond a shadow of a doubt any assertion that they make. If you ask me. It was a protest over Freddie Gray. The guy who was riding down the street on his bicycle and then got murdered by the cops. That was it. The best they had on him was that he had a knife in his pocket, but that's not a crime. And that wasn't why they pulled him over. The only debate now is whether they crushed his vertebrae before or after they put him in the back of the paddy wagon. But it looks like they have a pattern in Baltimore of putting people with their hands chained behind their backs in the back of the big truck, you know, in the big paddy wagon, empty space back there. And then they go driving around really fast and then slam on their brakes, send the people in the back flying. And apparently they've had a few broken necks and crushed skulls and this kind of thing from the rough paddy wagon ride in the past. This is just more of the same there. And, yeah, somebody broke some windows. I saw a cop car with a broken window or something like that. And that's bad PR for the justice for those murdered by police faction. But then again, you know, I don't know whether it was undercover informants. I guess I would assume that it was a bunch of undercover informant provocateur types trying to ruin it for everybody else, or maybe just a couple of dumbasses. But they shouldn't be able to take away from what everybody else was doing there. Anyway, I guess it says here multiple storefronts were vandalized. I saw footage of a Quickie Mart. Went and looted a Quickie Mart. I mean, what do they have of value in there? Beer? You know what I mean? I'm going to break into this place and get some beer. Wahoo! In the middle of a freaking riot? I don't know. Anyway, one of the things that was most notable about this is that CNN and MSNBC both were covering the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where the media and the politicians all get together and prove what sycophants they all are, both to each other, but mostly the media to power. And usually this is only on C-SPAN anyway. Usually this isn't even on the cable news channels, right? But they refused to break away to live footage of this police riot. And there's some crazy pictures out on that I saw on Twitter of and video of the cops all basically rioting on the protesters. A swarm of, maybe 100-something cops. All rushing and beating the crap out of all the protesters, whether they were quote-unquote violent or not. But nah, you know what? Let's watch the president tell jokes. Gotta love dear leader in an empire. That's all we got, right? All right. Oh, man, I didn't have time to read this one. I forgot about it. But check it out. McClatchy, D.C., formerly secret report on surveillance released. And this is, it's about Stellar Wind. It's about the completely lawless Bush administration program. Now, the Obama program is the exact same one, only under color of unconstitutional legislation, at least. So that makes it better. But anyway, new report about Stellar Wind. And there's a report about that by Michael Doyle in McClatchy Newspapers. And then this story in Rare. Tom Cotton is about to go to war with Rand Paul over the Patriot Act. Of course, a huge part, and there are all different loopholes. There are basically three major authorities for the illegal, unconstitutional spying program. There's Patriot Act Section 215, which the author of the Patriot Act, Richard Sensenbrenner, Representative Sensenbrenner, said, hey, I wrote that, and I never meant that to mean bulk surveillance. Give me a break. Mass surveillance. That's not in there, but that's how they twist it. And then there's FISA Amendments Act Section 702, and then there's Executive Order 12333, and those are the authorities for this kind of thing. And anyway, so Rand Paul apparently wants to rein in the Patriot Act, at least parts of it, let parts of it sunset, and Tom Cotton's going to fight for it. And, you know, this is where Rand Paul's entire attitude really disappoints to me, because... Or I don't know, I guess it depends how hard he fights. Maybe if he says it all soft, but he actually really fights hard, maybe that'll be okay. But this guy, Tom Cotton, is a real nightmare. And he may be completely full of it, but he believes it. And he comes with, you know, a dump truck full of certainty. So you put him head-to-head against Rand Paul on anything, he's got the advantage. Because he's got the consensus of the conservative right and the Republican Party behind him. And the entire war party and all their media behind him. And he's completely unafraid to stake out his position and fight like hell for it. Whereas Rand is, nobody knows what the hell wishy-washy position he's flip-flopped or landed on as of recently. You know, just today he was on Fox News saying, oh yeah, no, the drone strikes, they're trying to get some Al-Qaeda and... Yeah, they killed some Americans, but then again, if they're American Al-Qaeda dudes, and there he is conflating the one that killed the hostage with the one that killed the American Al-Qaeda guy, Adam Gadon, when there are different drone strikes in the first place. But then he says, you know, I don't know, man, you got to kill them. Hey, they're on a battlefield. They're, you know, if you kidnap somebody, the cops don't need a warrant to go in your house. They go right in. So, you know, felony in progress doctrine, and just go ahead and hold the hostages. I say go ahead and kill you, but then you don't want to kill the hostages. But then, yeah, you know, I don't know. It's probably all right. I guess, you know, can't criticize the president. He's trying his best. What is your position again, dude? Drone war is good. Meanwhile, what's his father? Well, you know exactly what his father would say about this. What do you say about this? Well, if there's really bad guys there, send in the Pakistani police to arrest them. That's how they got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib and 100 other terrorists. Send in the Pakistani police to arrest them. Hey, we think we found Adam Gadon. We think we found our hostage. We think we found an Al-Qaeda safe house. Go in and arrest him. Pretty simple argument to make. But Rand Paul, man, no, first priority is figure out what he thinks you want him to say, depending on who you are. And then, you know, run a little trigonometry program in his brain and figure out, well, but yeah, but who's got more votes and more money before he answers. So he comes out all wishy-washy. It's going to be hard to defeat Tom Cotton that way.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, every weekday. Our guest today is Patrick Coburn. He's Middle East correspondent for The Independent at independent.co.uk, and he's the author of the new book, The Rise of Islamic State, ISIS, and the New Sunni Revolution. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Good to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Really incredible story going on here with this war. The headline at antiwar.com this morning is Saudi warplanes pound Yemen capital, war seen as broadening, and warships attack port city of Aden. And your headline is Yemen crisis. This exotic war will soon become Europe's problem. I hardly know where to begin, but I guess let's start with this. The boatloads of refugees, as we're seeing from Libya right now, you're predicting these kinds of further consequences from this war in Yemen, consequences being something that the leadership in Britain and the United States never seem to take into account when they do any of these things.
Sure, yeah. I mean, they've been backing the Saudi air campaign and the Saudi blockade of Yemen. I mean, Yemen has 26 million people. Even before this happened, half of them were on the edge of malnutrition, according to UN agencies. And now a lot of them are beginning to starve. Yemen imports 90% of its food. That's not coming in. There's no electricity, so they can't pump water. There's no fuel. So in Sana'a, the capital today, they've been appealing for private motorists who've still got a little fuel to come and pick up the dead and wounded because they've got no gasoline for the ambulances. So, you know, this is an extraordinary man-made disaster. There's a lot of publicity today about the earthquake in Nepal, but the actual numbers of people affected are much greater in Yemen. You've got 12 million people who are on the edge of starvation. And this is, you know, the earthquake for the moment is over. But this, the bombing's been going on. It's been going on today.
And is the United Nations or any other organization, any part of the GCC or a neighboring government trying to do anything to provide relief to the people there?
Well, the GCC is backing Saudi Arabia and this air campaign. There's the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Gulf monarchies. Not much is being done.
You know, I mean, in America usually drops pudding cups on people.
This is completely cut off. I think the rest of the world treats it as being Saudi Arabia's backyard. So they just keep away from the problem. But I think what's going to happen is exactly what we've seen happen in Libya, what we've seen happen in Syria, is that you have people in Yemen reduced to complete desperation. So a proportion of them will try and, you know, run away to get to Europe. They'll pay, you know, use their last few dollars to get that boat from Libya or Egypt heading for Italy. You know, a lot of them will drown. But, you know, that's where this impulse comes from that the Europeans complain about, you know, how do we stop this great wave, is that they tolerate or provoke or do nothing to prevent these wars which reduce millions of people to complete poverty, hopelessness, and desperation. That's why they clamber onto sinking boats in order to try and make it to Sicily.
Yeah. Well, in Yemen, I don't know how many different countries are like this, but that sounds like a pretty unique situation if they truly import 90% of their food from elsewhere. That puts them in a very vulnerable spot in this kind of crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's, you know, I used to go to Yemen quite a bit. You know, it's very mountainous. It's highly populated. Quite a lot of it is, looks big on the map, but quite a lot in the east is desert. It has a little oil, little gas, but not much of that. Even before this happened, the situation was pretty dire. Now it's got a lot worse.
And now, so to rewind a little bit about how we got into this mess, how they got into this mess, I guess, so we don't have to go all the way back necessarily to the Houthi takeover, the so-called Zaydi Shiite rebels from the north taking over the country, but maybe if you could explain why that's such a big deal to the Saudis, that they started this bombing campaign, and why they couldn't just, as you say, the Houthis' domination of the country wasn't likely to last very long or be very substantial anyway. And so why have the Saudis been so hell-bent on destroying Yemen the way they've done?
It's a good question that, I mean, one should say, Yemeni politics tend to be pretty complicated. There is tribal identity. The Houthis belong to a certain tribes. They come from the far north of Yemen. They belong to the Zaydi sect, which is rather like the Shia, but is very only found in Yemen. Yemeni politics are very distinct, and it's very unlikely that any single faction will be able to dominate the country for very long. But what's really made it different this time around, and we've had sort of fighting in Yemen before, is that Saudi Arabia weighed in and said this was an attempted takeover by Iranian-backed Shia. Now, there isn't much evidence that the Iranians are involved in any significant extent. It's a kind of ludicrous claim that the Iranians were sending weapons to Yemen. Now, the one thing Yemen is not short of is arms. UN estimated there are between 40 and 60 million weapons in the country. That should make anybody in the NRA feel a glow. There are plenty of weapons there. So the Saudis then, why have they done it? Well, I think they want to show that they're going to oppose Iran, oppose the Shia. They haven't been doing very well in Iraq and Syria. So they've claimed that the same sort of thing is happening in Yemen, which is easier for them to intervene because it's landlocked. It's surrounded by Saudi Arabia on much of its frontier. It's easier for the Saudis to do. Now, there may be something to do with Saudi politics here. There's a new king, King Salman, mm-hmm. who's only been there a few months. The Minister of Defense is his favorite son, Mohammed, who's also chief of the royal court. It may be that they want to have a cheap, successful little war to establish the new king in place, to appeal to Saudi patriotism, to describe all opponents as traitors. So that may have something to do with solidifying the regime in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's difficult to work out what their long-term plan is, because it may be that the Houthis weren't pro-Iranian to begin with, but after they've been pounded by Saudi Arabia for long enough, they'll certainly end up that way.
Yeah,
of course, the U.S. is also pretty upset because there for years, the administration in Washington has been claiming success in its drone attacks on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen, and claims to have killed its leadership. But because of this war, suddenly al-Qaeda is presenting itself as the shock troops of the Sunni community. It's taken over a whole province in the south. It's taken over an airport in Hadramaut, a province, Hadramaut area in Yemen. So, this is kind of bad news for the U.S. as well.
Yeah, even though we're helping coordinate the whole dang war from offshore and in the air. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Patrick Coburn from The Independent and author of The Rise of Islamic State right after this. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Talking with Patrick Coburn from theindependent.co.uk. Quite a few very important Yemen articles for you to read here. We're talking about the humanitarian crisis there, the politics behind the war, and the irony of flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force here, America and the Saudis. I was going to say, geez, it seems like you can't win a regime change from the air. This whole thing is pointless. They're going to have to call it off. But then you made the very important point that they're really serving as cover for Al-Qaeda as the shock troops on the ground. And, you know, maybe Al-Qaeda, as much the, well, I guess if you could please describe what gains they've made so far for us, Patrick, and whether you think that maybe they'll take Sana as long as they have America and Saudi Arabia in the air backing them up.
Well, yeah, I think it's, you see, I don't think the Saudis had a thought through plan. I don't think they intended this to benefit, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is, after all, against the Saudi monarchy. But they've ended up by doing that very thing, by emphasizing sectarianism, by claiming the Houthis are Iranian-backed Shia. It's sort of a self-fulfilling description. About two-thirds of Yemenis are Sunni, and about one-third are this variant of Shiism called Zaydism. You know, Yemenis, when you talk to them, say, oh, we're not sectarian, it's not like Iraq or Syria here. You know, but I've heard that sort of thing before in both Iraq and Syria. You know, sectarian hatred and fear is only sort of one massacre away. And then people really do begin to notice what religion their neighbor belongs to. So Al-Qaeda benefits from any militarization of the situation, because you then have the Sunni under pressure from the Houthis, who are pretty well organized and very experienced. They sustained six offensives launched by the central government between 2004 and 2010. I mean, very ferocious warfare. So they're pretty experienced soldiers. Then they end up fighting the Sunni. Then the Sunni will look, as they looked in Iraq and they looked in Syria, to who are the toughest guys, who are the most militarily experienced guys around. And the answer is very simple. It's Al-Qaeda. So they benefit from this sort of thing. Then the U.S. Is in this peculiar situation of backing up this Saudi attack and partly organizing it, when the main beneficiary on the ground is their declared enemy, Al-Qaeda. It's kind of, you know, this kind of contradictory policy is why, you know, since 2003, since 9/11, we've had the Great War on Terror, billions, trillions of dollars spent, and Al-Qaeda and variants on Al-Qaeda are stronger than ever.
Yeah, well, of course, the hijackers were all from our allied states. That's why they attacked us, because they hated the empire's relationship with the dictatorships in Saudi and Egypt primarily, right? And so here it's been, even during the Iraq War, wasn't it the Saudis who were financing the Sunni-based insurgency against the American pro-Iranian occupation the whole time that we've considered the Iranians to be the enemy and the Shiites the enemy? We're fighting for them in Iraq while our allies, the Saudis, have been fighting against us all along.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of weird situation that they whereby the Saudis, the money for terrorism, quote-unquote, according to a whole series of reports, official reports from Washington, comes from private donors in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. And now if you talk to politicians in Baghdad or in Kurdistan, they believe exactly the same thing is happening in Islamic State. Lots of people deny this, but Islamic State seems to have a lot of money. And it's kind of difficult to believe that with so many sympathizers in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, that money isn't still flowing from there. So I think that Yemen is, you know, is one more occasion when this is happening. And we now have seven, if you go from Pakistan, over to right across, to northeast Nigeria, there are seven wars going on in Muslim countries. In all of these, Al-Qaeda is either strong or is getting stronger. It used to have no presence in Libya. Now it's been murdering Egyptians and cutting off the heads of Ethiopian migrants. It's becoming a force on the ground. So very few wars have failed so decisively as the war on terror.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder if we fight it any better, and I've read a couple articles by you where you seem to recommend that there's a good way to go about this, but I just can't imagine the government's ever, you know, being that smart about it. And it seems like if we ally with the strongest factions that we have to ally with against the Islamic State, that would be the Iranians and Assad, and if we do that, then that just plays into their hands and makes their narrative about us right, that it's us and the Israelis and the Shiites against them, and just push even more people to their cause.
Yeah, it's...
Maybe even reunite Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, who are now separate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, you know, Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, the jihadis, they've never been that different, you know. They fight each other, but their ideology is very much the same. The way they behave, the way they treat women, the way they treat minorities, be they Christian or Shia, is really pretty similar. So there's an attempt sort of at the moment to... take some of the jihadis in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate there, and pretend that it's very different from Islamic State. It's a kind of gentler sort of Al-Qaeda. I mean, this is kind of rubbish, really. Yeah, there is a way of combating this. If you give priority, let's say, to fighting the Islamic State, then you have to have a relationship with the main people who are doing the fighting on the ground. Now, to some extent, the U.S. has done that. You know, they used to regard the Syrian Kurds as their organization as terrorists. Now they're supplying airstrikes. This is what saved the city of Kobani. In Iraq, they've tried to sort of support the Iraqi army and not the Shia militias. But the Iraqi army only has about 5,000 combat troops who really fight. Other than that, it has sort of tens of thousands of guys who sort of sit at checkpoints, but run away anytime the Islamic State turns up. So it's not really feasible. If that's your strategy, then Islamic State wins. I think what they got to do is really look at who their allies in practice are going to be on the ground, which in Iraq may be the Shia militias. And it's reasonable for them to ask, you know, to ask for these people to pay a price, you know, that to allow Sunni back into areas that where the Islamic State has been expelled. And in Syria, above all, what happens if Islamic State is fighting the Syrian army, which is the main military force opposing them? If that goes down, then the jihadis are going to head for Damascus. You're going to have a really big state controlled by these very crazy guys. And that's a decision that Washington has put off taking.
Yeah. Well, you know, I couldn't recommend intervening in Syria on behalf of Assad or even imagine the Americans doing that unless it came down to really the fall of Damascus, which, hey, the Yarmouk camp is just right there pretty much, right? But backing the jihadists this whole time, as you've been reporting since 2011 and 12, and backing the revolution against Assad is outright madness, especially now when we're almost a year out from the declaration of the caliphate here. For them to still have the policy that Assad's got to go seems pretty far out, and yet it seems to still be the policy, right?
Yeah. they kind of don't have a policy. I mean, or, you know, it is that Assad should go, but of course, could they be really horrified if he did go? You know, they don't have to marry him. All they have to do is attack Islamic State when it's attacking the Syrian army, which is rather different from supporting Assad. At the moment, they say, the enemy of our enemy is not necessarily our friend. But actually, you know, if Islamic State is fighting the Syrian army, you don't bomb the Islamic State, or you don't do anything about it, then you're effectively letting them win. So long as that situation goes on, then Islamic State is going to be there. You know, it's not going down. You see a lot of optimistic stuff in the papers. The Pentagon released a map claiming the Islamic State had lost a quarter of its territory. I mean, first of all, it just hasn't. And secondly, it's a rather interesting map because they've cut off the western end of the Islamic State where it's actually been expanding around Damascus. Mm-hmm. That bit of the map isn't there. You know, so it's a graphically explains what the Pentagon would like to be happening, but actually isn't happening.
But now to really defeat them, to drive them out of power in Raqqa and in Mosul and turn them back into a fairly small insurgency, you know, and something that's not a threat to arise immediately again without an occupation, what would it take? The Turkish and the Iranian armies, the American Marine Corps to go in there and flush them out of there? Who has the power, the ability to do it? And I don't think the Turks or the Iranians have the willingness to go that far, right?
No, but I think that, you know, at the moment, I think you need to bring the Shia militias more under government control in Baghdad, but effectively regard them as the main fighting force of the Baghdad government, because that's the real situation. And kind of the U.S. is kind of supporting them with airstrike. I mean, this prevents at least the Islamic State getting any stronger, and that will turn the military balance against them. I think in Syria, yeah, I think they should attack the Islamic State in the west where it's fighting the Syrian army, and I think they should demand from Assad that there's a ceasefire you know, you can't share power in Damascus in the government because they hate each other too much, but you could share power geographically on the ground. Islamic State benefits from, and the jihadis benefit from, the militarization of the situation, because they're basically fighting machines, but so does Assad. You know, Assad benefits from a lot of people in Damascus, from the minorities, the Alawites, the Christians, the Druze, but also a lot of Sunni who work for the government, thinking we don't much like Assad, but we've got no alternative with these crazies at the gate. Now, if you can have a ceasefire in a lot of Syria, in provinces that are being fought over at the moment, you can't have it with the Islamic State because they're not into ceasefires, and then that's good for Syrians. You need to try and get the refugees back and have a more normal situation. The problem in a lot of these cities is, you know, on the one side you have the Syrian army, then you have an area that they're bombarding. Inside that you have fighters, and you have the fighters' family, and you have people who are too poor to move. You need to try and normalize the situation, get these millions and millions of refugees back. But at the moment, there's really no attempt to do that.
Yeah, well, and it seems like the government, as you say, they can't rule the whole country and there's too much bad blood there, but there's really no one to rule Syrian Sunnistan other than al-Nusra and ISIS at this point, right? I mean, this was Hillary's excuse for not doing more to back the rebels back in 2012, was we don't really see anyone on the ground to work with there. So it's kind of just, what do you do? The whole place is going to be ruled by Al-Qaeda A or Al-Qaeda B.
Well, you know, the first thing to do is to prevent them winning. You know, these guys are not losing at the moment. And one of the, you know, I wrote this book, Rise of Islamic State, in the first half of 2014, before they'd taken Mosul. At that time, I sort of wrote it, I was kind of frustrated that it seemed to me pretty obvious these guys were getting stronger and stronger in a very big area. You know, the size of Great Britain, from stretching right from the Iranian border almost to the Mediterranean. And you could see that. They'd taken a big city like Fallujah. The Iraqi army couldn't get it back. but nobody seemed to pay much attention. And I have slightly the same feeling now that I keep reading sort of optimistic stuff in the papers, you know, put out by the Pentagon, put out by the Baghdad government. But it's kind of wishful thinking. I wish it wasn't, but it really is. The Iraqi army isn't coming together. You know, they only have a very few units that will actually do any fighting. The Islamic State is recruiting in the area, which it controls. There are about 6 million people there. An awful lot of young men that you can conscript into their, as fighters. And in Syria, they're expanding their area around Damascus. They've taken Yarmouk camp, which is about 3 or 4 miles from the center of Damascus. So I think that there's a sort of, they don't know what to do, and they kind of want to just pretend that the situation isn't as serious as it really is.
Well, now, so are they a real threat to what's left of the Syrian army? What is left of the Syrian army? I mean, they can hold the capital
fighting,
or
it's
not?
A bit fought out. One of the problems is that it's fighting the Islamic State, then it's fighting these other jihadis backed by Turkey and Saudi Arabia up in the northwest in Idlib province. It's taken the Idlib city there, the provincial capital, and it's fighting south of Damascus. So it's fighting really these two different wars, and particularly the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, and his defense minister is Mohammed. Seem to have launched a more aggressive Saudi policy. They have greater willingness to involve Saudi Arabia in these battles. Previously, Saudi Arabia used its influence, it used its money, but they were kind of cautious. They operated through proxies mostly. But now we're seeing both in Syria and Yemen, the Saudis taking a much more aggressive stance. And this further destabilizes the situation.
All right. Well, I've already kept you way over time here. Thank you very much for your time, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, so that's the great Patrick Coburn reporting for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And the book is The Rise of Islamic State, ISIS and the New Sunni Revolution. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys. So, yeah, I'm just terrible about the hard breaks, man. You know? I don't know. I didn't want to interrupt the man. He was saying a bunch of stuff I wanted to hear. You know, actually he was saying a bunch of stuff I didn't want to hear, but you know what I mean. Wanted to hear him say the stuff I didn't want to hear. Anyway. So you will be able to go to the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews and hear the end of that interview later on. And yeah, I'm sorry, the whole show archives are still broken, but soon they'll be fixed. And apparently the podcast feed is still broken, but soon it'll be better, maybe. I don't know, man. It's all very complicated. In the future, I'll have an R2-D2, and I'll say to him, "Hey, man, would you please fix the thing and make it work right?" And then he'll just take care of it, and it'll be fine. But for now, I've got to rely on humans. Humans with other higher priorities than my hardware and software, unfortunately. But anyway, it is what it is. We'll work it out. It'll get worked out, and you get the thing. You know, this used to happen all the time, so we should be grateful and thankful that this doesn't happen that often anymore. We are just on a temporary server now. I'm going to do a Kickstarter and buy 2 brand new servers with all high-tech, fancy new crap on them that'll last. a server A and a server B kind of thing. Anyway, scotthorton.org, you can find, I think all the interviews work. Sorry that the whole show archives aren't updated. Those are going to be the hardest ones to catch up with, too, you know. But I'm going to talk to the guys today and see what I can do about, you know, see what I can do. Yeah, you know, I don't like what Coburn says about should do something. I mean, he's caught, okay, forget all unbending libertarian ideology for a minute. Taking into account the precepts of most humans on Earth that sometimes military force is applicable or whatever. You know, he made a good argument. I'm not saying I buy it. But he did make a good argument that, hey, if ISIS is really ready to take Damascus and destroy the Syrian army, you really want that, man? No, yeah, we should bomb them if that happens. And, you know, I don't know. It is certainly, as Patrick and I both have been saying on this show, me mostly because I'm parroting him on this show for years. Jesus, it's already the future. It's the spring of 2015 right now. That's like the equivalent of 1985 to 1980 kind of thing. You know what I mean? 81. And it was in 2011 when this madness began. And I says to Coburn, I says, hey, man, the Saudis, the Americans, they're backing the Mujahideen in a war against Assad. Am I right about this? What the hell is this? It's kind of crazy and counterproductive to our real goals and these kinds of things, right? And he would say, yes. He would report that. You heard him just now. I think this wasn't in the break. This was during the part of the segment you could hear, right, where he was saying that there's really no difference between al-Nusra and the Islamic State. They're trying to rebrand al-Nusra now as the moderates. Al-Nusra, the guys who are still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. They're the moderates? They were the ones who back in 2012 shot the kid in the face, the 15-year-old kid at the fruit stand, who said to the guy, no, I won't give you a discount. This is the price for a pair, or whatever it was. I wouldn't even give a discount to Muhammad right now. And they shot him in the face for that. Cutting people's heads off and crucifying them. Declaring outright their loyalty to Zawahiri back as early as 2012. David Enders from McClatchy Newspapers was on this show regularly saying, yeah, not many moderates in this fight. It's a bunch of guys who don't mind dying. It wasn't until the spring of 2013 that the Islamic State broke off from the al-Nusra front. And then Coburn said, yeah, it's all pretty much the same thing anyway. Different leaders, different tactics or different strategies, same tactics, different strategies. But, you know, he asked them, he was in Turkey and was meeting with all these guys, the so-called FSA moderates who were basically just al-Nusra's arms liaisons to the NATO forces, right? And said, so what do you guys think of September 11th? And they were all like, yeah, we love it. More like that, please. These are the guys we're backing. And as he said, you know, there are these different groups, the Ahrar al-Sham, the Islamic Front, and this and that, backed by the Saudis. But again, they're just basically the arms middlemen for the al-Nusra Front and ISIS, who end up with all their best equipment. I haven't seen it put two and two together 100% solid anywhere else, I don't think, but I'm pretty sure that it's not a coincidence that it was widely reported that the State Department was sending a bunch of trucks to the moderates, non-lethal supplies, right? Fleets, especially of Toyota, what do they call them? Helixes. The Saudi special. And then those were the trucks that the Islamic State took into Iraq when they invaded Iraq in June of last year. I can't prove it 1,000% certain, but I'm quite sure the very same fleet of trucks that the FSA got and either gave or sold to the jihadists The worst ones, the Islamic State or al-Nusra, or were taken from them. Same difference. The guys over at the blog of war, the blogs of war were saying, hey, look at this, man. America gives TOW missiles, shoulder-fired anti-tank missiles, to Ahrar al-Sham, part of the Free Syrian Army. And the next thing you know, they're in battle side by side with the Islamic State. And, with al-Nusra. And which one's which? Which one's the so-called moderate and which one's the jihadist? As they're destroying the... You know, you can't really call them moderates, I don't guess. Although, I don't know. The Syrian government is backed by a coalition of minorities who all have a hell of a lot to lose. I mean, I know I'm beating a dead horse for you regular listeners of the show, but it seems like a pretty simple way to get the idea across to people. Remember how in the Iraq War, mainstream critics, never mind radicals like myself, mainstream critics would say things like, well, you know, getting rid of Saddam was one thing, but it was a real mistake the way they de-Ba'athified the government, that is, completely and totally abolished the state in its entire form, and abolished the entire army, and just sent everybody home with all their guns and no money, and created, you know, just set about a giant insurgency to fight. What a disaster that was. 1 million people died in the civil war that came after. 1 million people. And so the thing of it is that that's exactly what they're doing right now against Assad. That's what they have been doing. Is trying to, if Assad is the Ba'athist dictator of Syria, he is. He's the Saddam of Syria, even though he's a Shiite with a Sunni majority instead of a Sunni with a Shiite majority. Still, they're trying to de-Ba'athify the government, abolish and dissolve the Syrian army, and then what? Civil war. And it's already been a civil war this whole time. A bloody grind. And, you know, it was admitted in the New York Times. It was a Judy Ruderin piece in the New York Times where the Israelis said, this is what we want, is for nobody to win, for them to just keep killing each other. They didn't have to say, and it doesn't matter how many innocent civilians die in this thing of wounds, of deprivation. Don't care about that. Don't calculate that one bit. And here you go. Speaking of the U.S.-backed moderates, here they are. Roy Gutman, who's pretty war propagandist-y for a McClatchy guy, says U.S.-backed rebels team with Islamists to capture strategic Syrian city. America fighting with al-Qaeda on the ground in Syria, according to Roy.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. Yeah, I'm sorry about the podcast feed, man. I know it's broken. I'm trying to fix it. It'll get fixed. Someday. All right. So, man, I just got too dang much to cover here. I better move on. I already had a whole damn Coburn interview over that and that. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. I tried to figure out ways to sum it up. You can hear how complicated it is in a conversation like that with Coburn, where America's fighting for our enemies and against our allies and all this crazy crap all over the damn region. And it'd be nice to just say, oh yeah, it's all a master plan or whatever, but, you know, I don't know, man. It's too much planning. I see interests, and I think that's what accounts for all the incoherence, is different interests win on different policies. And so, geez, we spent all this time building up the Shiite government of Iraq. It'd be too embarrassing to go ahead and call them the Iranian-backed enemy and turn on them and fight for the Islamic State there now. That'd be crazy. But then again, it's not very crazy to go ahead and back the Mujahideen against Assad, because, after all, he never was really our sock puppet, even though Bush paid him to torture, Bill Clinton and George Bush paid him to torture and murder people for us. And he was in a coalition that invaded Iraq with us under George Bush's father. Well, I guess that was his father, Assad's father. High fist. But anyway. So, yeah, we can, you know, if the Turks and the Saudis and the Israelis all hate Assad and want him to go, then, yeah, fine, let's go ahead and let them win out on that policy. And then when it comes to Saudi Arabia, I love Coburn's answer. I don't know if it's really the truth, but it sure sounds true to me. Hey, Coburn, why does Saudi want to bomb Yemen so bad? What the hell they care about the Houthis? As you said, they can't really be the government of the whole country anyway, when they got Al-Qaeda here and they got the socialists there and they have all these different factions, Saleh and his half of the army. So why do it? And he said, politics, domestic politics in Saudi Arabia. The new king has a young son who's the Minister of the Interior or whatever, which means right the head of the secret police, murderers or whatever. And he has to make a name for himself. It's the public choice theory of the Saudi princes who slaughter Yemenis and then enlist Americans as their sock puppets to coordinate the entire attack. And then, boy, you got to appreciate Obama's PR offensive on the Yemen front. We keep trying to tell the Saudis to stop it, but then right there in the New York Times, in the same damn paper, there's Obama saying the job isn't finished yet. Continue. Which, why is that even necessary? You gotta say that publicly? You don't just call them? These guys are crazy, man. So anyway, but don't worry, it'll guarantee many, many hundreds of thousands more dead people. Again, just imagine the nightmare scenario. Damascus falls, the Ba'athist army is dissolved, and Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS are left to fight against the minority militias, what's left of them, and then each other for control over all of Syria. For crying out loud, man. That'd be the beginning of a whole new set of horrifying circumstances and consequences there. Holy crap. And as Coburn, it was a throwaway line in that interview, although I know he didn't mean it that way, but all through Africa too now. And every group of Sunnis with rifles who want any attention and influence just call themselves Al-Qaeda or call themselves the Islamic State. And then they get that much more cachet. Not what they call it. Oh. Anyway. What a goddamn disaster. And then so, in a giant sectarian war, where America's only enemies involved are the Al-Qaeda guys, doesn't it seem odd that we're taking their side against the Iranians? What the hell have the Iranians ever done to us other than overthrow our sock puppet dictatorship of their government back almost 40 years ago? You know, if Ronald Reagan can sell them weapons, certainly we can get along. Don't you think? If even Ronald Reagan could sell them weapons, we ought to be able to get along with them. Well, the answer, of course, is because that's what Israel wants. And I guess, yeah, that's what Saudi wants. But more than any, and Turkey. I don't know about Turkey on that one. I know they hate Assad. I don't know what they're like with Iran. But anyway, that's what Israel wants. That's the big deal. And there's really no denying it here. If you look at the political news, the 2016 GOPers court pro-Israel donors at Sheldon Adelson's unofficial primary. Sheldon Adelson, the gambling billionaire who has called for the nuking of Iran, a demonstration nuke, out on the outskirts of town, just to let them know that we want them to dismantle their civilian nuclear program. This guy, I love, he's made all his money in gambling, and he's the guy pulling all the strings in the Republican Party now. Yeah, never mind what your minister said about that. That's where all his money and all his influence comes from. And then, so all of these guys, they have to swear that when they become president, they will destroy any nuclear deal that Obama succeeds in gaining here. This is the Adelson primary, they're calling it. And you know, they're calling all of these guys, Rubio and Cruz, they're calling for all these amendments. I don't know. We'll see what Rand does. He's still putting it off and putting it off and refusing to take a stand. I wouldn't bet on him doing the right thing. But he has been half good on this issue in the past. He's voted for sanctions, but he's also voted against sanctions at times where it really could have screwed up the negotiations. And he signed the Cotton Letter, and then he tried to double back and say, oh no, I did it just to strengthen Obama's hand. Which, rather than undermine it, which was the purpose of the letter. But they're trying to add all these amendments to the Corker sanctions bill that says that the Iranians will have to, they'll have to do what the political culture in Israel has yet to decide to do. And that is declare themselves officially, in law, a Jewish state. That's not even a done deal in Israel. And they want the Iranian government not just to recognize Israel, but to call it a Jewish state at the expense of all the Palestinians who live in the occupied territories and in so-called Israel proper, too. Just as a poison pill to kill this deal, just to move the goalposts way the hell over there and destroy the deal. Of course, they've offered to recognize Israel within 67 borders, but let's not talk about that, okay, guys? Look, nukes. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in. My website is scotthorton.org. Okay, it mostly works. The podcast doesn't seem to be pushing these things out, man. And the whole show archives, they're not updated there. But at least we posted at scotthorton.org all the interviews from the last couple of weeks that you might have missed when the site was down. And anyway, as you might be able to tell, the show runs on a pretty much shoestring budget here. It doesn't require much to just barely make it go. But the only reason that it does go is because of the sponsors of this show. And that means, first and foremost, Mike Swanson from the author of The War State and the author of all the investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. Great guy, great sponsor of the show. And then there's Phil Giraldi and the Council for the National Interest. And their deal is an America first foreign policy. Imagine that. Instead of Israel first like it is every other time by everybody else. Taxpayers United of America. And their Fighting Government Pensions workshops. They've all been going really well and they're working on the next one. And what a great project. You have no idea how much your so-called public servants are making off of you. It's absolutely outrageous. Fighting Government Pensions, a workshop by Taxpayers United of America. Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. Look, you buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, palladium. You got to own some silver. Got to own some gold, especially for just in case for something. For the next 2008... Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. at rrbi.co. RRBI.co, the Future Freedom Foundation, that's Jacob Hornberger's group there, and the Future Freedom magazine that they put out. Subscribe to that. It's just $15 a year to read online, $25 a year. Yeah, come on. Help support the FFF, man. $25 a year, get a great little booklet. It's small, so it's not imposing. You know, there's some good articles in there. You can give it to some friends, leave it around somewhere for people to read. You subversive you. Darren's Coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Now, Darren, if you're listening right now, I need you to send me some more coffee. I'm back on the Folgers, which I ain't spoiled. I'm happy to drink Folgers. It really ain't that bad, you know. But what I would really like is some Darren's Coffee. I never really was good enough at skateboarding to be sponsored. But if I was, I would have liked to be sponsored by a coffee company. I'm very happy that this show is sponsored by a coffee company. I like coffee. I like Darren's Coffee. It's really freaking good, man. And so the thing is, you guys need to not just hear me say these things. You need to act on these things. You need to support the FFF, support CNI, read Mike Swanson's book, buy a couple of extra copies and donate them to the library. You need to drink Darren's Coffee instead of the brand that you drink. Help support those who help support this show, if you want there to be a show. Which some of you do, I can tell. And you know what? I shouldn't leave out Go-Kart Galaxy and also Whole Food Multi-Complete. They buy web ads from me for the website, which has been down. Oh, and you know what? I knew there was one missing here, and it's the Jay Moore Show. Man, I better write that on my hand. Yeah, I gotta run a web ad for the Jay Moore Show. It's been a very chaotic couple of weeks with the website, you understand. So yeah, check him out too. Patronize those who would patronize this show. Okay? Do that. Also, shop at Amazon. You know, the Amazon thing is a good deal. They sell everything in the world that you could possibly need, deliver it right to your door someday with drones. But anyway, if you just stop by scotthorton.org/Amazon, I mean, that'll forward you on right there. Or just go and click the Amazon link on the right side of the page there at scotthorton.org. Anything you buy after that, I'll get a kickback from their end of the deal. And when a lot of you buy just a little bit of stuff, or sometimes big stuff, one guy bought a stove on their oven range, like you get on The Price is Right. A lot of people buy a lot of stuff. A lot of people buy a lot of little stuff, but a lot times a lot is a lot. You know how that works. You could have flunked out of ninth grade and still know that part. So how it works is, you know, not a lot. I mean, relatively more than you might imagine or something kind of thing, you know, buy a lot. So do that. Whenever you go shopping, you buy something at Amazon.com, you want to help support the show, just stop by scotthorton.org/Amazon or click through the link there and do your shopping that way. And I get a little bit of a kickback, and it helps with the bills. The cost of living, it keeps going up. They keep saying that the CPI ain't budging, but I keep feeling it. I'll tell you what. All right. So, yeah, and thank you. There are a lot of people who subscribe and donate 10, 20, 5, 10, 20, sometimes more per month. You can sign up for that at scotthorton.org/donate. There's a thing there to want to help support the show. And I am going to get a Kickstarter going here very soon on the subject of the new servers. But I'll make that a separate little self-contained kind of a project. And then maybe I'll do kind of a spring fundraiser after that. Because, you know, I got some upgrading of some things around here that need doing. And some things like that. But thank you, everybody, for supporting the show. I appreciate your support for the show. Again, scotthorton.org for all that kind of information, if you want it. Hope I didn't leave any of my sponsors out. Oh, god dang, liberty.me. They're supporting the show, too. And I got a show there with Jeff Tucker. It's like a libertarian Facebook. to oversimplify it. There's more to it than that. There's no ads on it because you're not the commodity. The site is the commodity, so you pay $4 or $5. No, if you use the promo code Scott, pay $4 a month. And it's pretty cool, man, and it's growing. It seems to be getting better and better. And there's a lot of great content on there, and so check it out. It's liberty.me. And I have a show there with Jeff Tucker, and that's going to be, what's the date? Right now is the 27th. Hey, that'll be this Friday, will be episode 4 of Eye on the Empire, which means I need to get with Jeff and we need to talk about what we're going to do on the show. That's, Jeff Tucker and I have a show on there about foreign policy. I think I need to interview him about the history of Rothbard and Vietnam and that kind of thing. What do you think about that? Is that someone a good idea? Jeff Tucker, Eye on the Empire. Oh, yeah, it's, you know, the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and all that. I'm sure Tucker can speak to Rothbard and all of that kind of thing. And let me make sure I didn't leave anybody else out. Not really. Okay, good deal. So, let me hit refresh on antiwar.com, make sure nothing too big is on fire since this morning. All right, good. All right, Putin, U.S. spy agencies backed Islamic separatists in the 2000s. Says Bush assured him the effort would stop. Now, I don't know that this is true, but I suspect that this is true. During interviews for a documentary on the early days of his presidency, Russian President Vladimir Putin claimed his government had intercepted phone calls made by U.S. intelligence assets in Azerbaijan to Islamist separatist groups in the northern Caucasus of Russia. Russia has faced, meaning I guess Dagestan or North Ossetia or something, Chechnya. Russia has faced several separatist movements in and around Chechnya since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Putin claimed to have confronted President George W. Bush with the evidence and to have been assured by Bush that he would prevent further actions and kick the asses of those agents responsible. This apparently didn't work as hoped, as Putin went on to say the Russian FSB. And I don't have time to finish that long paragraph. Back in a minute. Wrap up the show. Scott Horton Show on LRN, Liberty Radio Network. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, y'all, welcome back. So, I was trying to remember, and then I did remember. So part two of this interview with Stephen F. Cohen in Salon.com, where he talks about how far Putin went to try to appease George W. Bush. He was the first foreign leader to call America on September 11th and tell George Bush, anything you need. I am your humble servant. Oh, you want to invade Afghanistan? Let me help you. And I know it's easy to be cynical and say, oh yeah, he was just trying to lure us into our own Vietnam again like we did to him and whatever. Maybe, but I don't think so. He was taking a major gamble that he could make Russia some kind of pseudo-equal partner to America. Not in a bipolar world sense, but in a true partnership kind of sense. Yes, let us kill jihadis together. You need to use our bases, etc., etc. And then what did Bush do? Within months, it was in December of 2001, unless I'm wrong, and I don't think I am, that Bush withdrew from the missile defense treaty. It was the I forgot what they call it, the ADM treaty, or ABM treaty. Yeah, anti-ballistic missile treaty, and then announced plans to put anti-missile missiles in Poland and in the Czech Republic. And then continued upon a policy of, especially Cheney picking a fight with the Russians, rhetorically, a campaign of color-coded revolutions against Russian-backed governments, like in Ukraine in 2004, in Kyrgyzstan in 2005, well, and really Georgia, and well, first, hell, I guess the first color-coded revolution was against Milosevic in, 2000? 2001, some. And then they overthrew Shevardnadze, I think is how you say it, in favor of Saakashvili in Georgia, who later attacked South Ossetia and almost got America into war with Russia in 2008. And then they tried the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon. I don't know exactly how Russian-backed they are, but anyway. Failed in that one, in the so-called Cedar Revolution. But anyway, the Bush administration just refused to accept friendship, any kind of pseudo-equal partnership based on mutual respect with Russia, and they expanded NATO. They brought, what, 4 or 5 more countries into NATO? And then said, what are you pissed off about? And, you know, as John Mearsheimer pointed out, I think it was Mearsheimer or was it Walt? One of the two. I get them confused with what they write sometimes. It was Walt in Foreign Policy. Stephen Walt wrote that Strobe Talbot, you know, the guy who wrote back in 1992 that soon we'll all recognize a single world government, the birth of the global nation, he called it. He was one of the greatest proponents of NATO expansion and sold it as basically just kind of course, you know, part and parcel of spreading democracy throughout the world. Where the EU goes, NATO goes too, because this is how we all get along. And don't worry, the Russians will never see this as any kind of threat to them, because it has nothing to do with threatening them. Of course not. And these are the same people now saying we must arm the Ukrainians because the Russians have reacted badly to our expansion into their hegemony. You know what? You don't have to be that good at geography to understand, as Pat Buchanan always says, that during the Cold War, the line was halfway across Germany. Really, 2/3 of the way across Germany, the Elbe River. Soviet Union, stay out of Western Europe, west of the Elbe River, and we won't nuke you. Now, we've moved that line all the way to Russia's border. We've brought the Baltic states into the NATO military alliance and have been working on and announced in 2008 outright that, yes, NATO, Ukraine is still on the path to full NATO membership. So I'm not saying that that justifies the Russian reaction, but if you think that the Russian reaction is just an action and the Americans are the ones reacting, then you got the story all backwards. And the perfect analogy would be if America, if Ronald Reagan had bankrupted the United States and the American Empire had fallen apart and the Soviet Union still stood and then expanded the Warsaw Pact and their Soviet system into Western Europe and into South America and then even so far as into Mexico and Canada. Yeah, at some point the Americans, wounded as they were from the collapse of their empire, still sitting on piles of nuclear weapons and with a sophisticated armed force, would react, would do something about it. It's the same damn thing. It's not a matter of justification or excuse making. It's just a matter of reality. What did you think you could do? Anything you wanted and no one would ever say no? And, you know, Vladimir Putin, as much as people try to say, oh, yeah, no, man, he's Hitler. Hillary Clinton called him Hitler. No, yeah, he's a Nazi, he's a fascist and all of this. Well, guess what? There are real right-wing extremists in Russia. He's not Hitler. He's Hindenburg, man. You sure you want to see the fall of Weimar Russia and its replacement with a real nationalist government? Boy, these neocons, man, they just are so smart, they know. They are certain that they're so smart that they know what to do and what they're doing. But, you know, if you just try to be objective about it for a second, you look at NATO expansion, You look at those who were its greatest proponents and how it's worked out exactly opposite of what they said. Again, I'll refer you back to the editor of Foreign Affairs, Gideon Rose, being interviewed on the Stephen Colbert show right a day or two after the coup d'etat in February 21st. So he's February the 24th, I believe, 23rd or 24th on the Colbert show, 2014, explaining how, yeah, see, the trick is to get away with it without provoking any kind of Russian response. Yeah, well, okay, so you failed. You set the standard for what this was supposed to look like, and look what it looks like instead. It's a freaking crisis. So now what? Double down? This is amazing to me, really, where you have Angela Merkel and, what's his name, Holland. Is it Francois? What's his damn name over there? Holland in France. They went over there and cut this deal with Putin, Minsk II, for a real ceasefire and autonomy for the eastern provinces, so there's not much left to fight over, kind of a thing. And the Americans, for mostly domestic political reasons, or I don't know what the hell madman reasons, arms sales reasons, they are pushing, just like we talked about the pickup trucks, those Helixes in Syria, they're pushing, in this case it's Humvees, for non-lethal military equipment, or if it's lethal, then defensive weapons, like so-called defensive missiles. And training, they're sending at least Army Rangers, if not Delta Force guys and Navy SEALs and whoever, to train up the Ukrainian National Guard, which is led, at least in some circumstances, by the Right Sector and Azov Battalion Nazis, descendants of Stepan Bandera and the Galician SS. Proud descendants. Did I say proud the first time? Oh, not like Hitler. Well, okay. A little like Hitler. That's what the guy, the one guy, told the BBC. Yeah, okay, like Hitler. Yeah, we just want a clean country, you understand? Clean. That's America's side. It's unbelievable what is true. And anyway, oh, by the way, look at antiwar.com/Justin today for Raimondo's column. Who hacked the White House? The Russia haters are sure they know, and that's basically the whole point, is they're just completely flip, unproven accusations that the Russians are behind the hacking of the president's email. Now, apparently, it's just his declassified account where he, you know, emails back the Cub Scouts and whatever, this kind of crap, I don't know. We're supposed to assume anyway. But they're blaming it on Russia based on, as Justin demonstrates in this article, no evidence whatsoever. Just more in that hysteria, more in that where there's smoke, there's fire kind of narrative they're trying to build for you there. Because they're crazy. I think, I guess.